believing in yourself, believing that, you know, it's possible. And if you want to do something, like getting out there and talking to the people who are doing it, because they are out there doing it, to educate yourself about the legal ways to do it and to set yourself up properly.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Lisa Hilton is the host of the Level Up REI podcast and founder of LisaHilton.com, a real estate investment firm that was created for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs to build passive income and wealth through tax-efficient real estate investments. When she's not buying real estate, you can find her hiking, paddleboarding, practicing yoga, taking an evening walk, swimming, traveling, and embarking on wine country getaways and trying new adventures. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Sam. I appreciate it.
Hey, the pleasure's all mine. Absolutely mine. If you can give our listeners just a quick, you know, background on where you started, where you are now, and how did you get there?
Sure. So I am originally from the Cayman Islands. So I started off growing up in the Cayman Islands. I went to college in the South. So I went to the University of Georgia for a degree in accounting, went home, worked for 4 years at PwC, and went with the firm to Boston for another 4 years. And then the last leg of my journey took me out here to Los Angeles, also with the firm, a total of 10 years with PwC. After that, I left to go work for an investment manager, working as a controller on private equity real estate funds. During that time, so I was there for 4.5 years. During that time is when I got exposed to real estate syndications. And I was very intrigued about the process and made my first investment, got bitten by the real estate syndication bug and decided to move forward from there. But I come from a real estate family. My father was a contractor, so he built 14 apartment units when I was a child. And during around when I was in middle school, he was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And by the time I got to college, he passed away. So by him making that investment early on, that enabled the family to continue to move forward. I'm one of three, and one of five. My parents each had one child before they got married, and then three children together. So yeah, definitely I know the power of real estate. And I bought my first property when I was in my early 20s living in Cayman. I bought it because I loved it, quickly realized that, hey, this stuff doesn't cash flow, held on to it for about 5 or 6 years, and here we are.
Wow, that's a really powerful story, because that's one of the things that people talk about all the time is, and in some respects, I feel like it can be oversold, which is this idea of develop passive income. Yes, you can. And depending on the right investment, yes, absolutely you can. But for you, that rings very true and personal in that, you know, your dad left assets that you guys could then continue to cash the check on for however long you guys held those.
Yep. And still do. My mom takes care of them. That's her retirement. She's been retired now for a while.
So. Wow. That's really cool. And what a great motivation to follow in his footsteps.
It took some time though.
I don't know. I think you're doing pretty good. So, you know, most investors, I'll ask this question, you know, most investors, they want to make a bunch of money in real estate so they can go to the Caymans. They don't leave the Caymans so they can go make a bunch of money in the real estate. So I won't even ask you why, but I just want to point that out, that there's a lot of us wishing we could go the other way.
Well, you know, I came to the U.S. for career purposes. That's what brought me here.
Understood.
And then as time went on, I guess the desire to invest in real estate returned, because when I sold my first property, I actually was like, you know what? No more real estate. I'm not doing that ever again. And then I say the universe has a sense of humor, because a year after I sold it, I got a job working as a controller on private equity real estate funds. And so, yeah. And then 6 months in, well, a friend who was working there, who left a month after I started, said to me, it'll take you 6 months to figure out what you're doing, and then 6 months to determine whether you like it or not. And she was right, because in that second 6 months, I realized, okay, I can do this, but I can't do this forever. So I need to start figuring out how to build the next chapter. It took me 4.5 years to get to the point where I could take the golden handcuffs off, but they were definitely on for a very long time.
Right, right. You know, but I think that you probably have a very interesting perspective that the rest of us that have that non-institutional, non-corporate background on how these deals are structured. I mean, because you this was a private equity real estate fund that you were running, or can you define that again for us?
Yeah. So I worked for an investment manager that raises funds. So okay. They have like, I think, $200 billion in AUM, but the So it's really large. And I think the real estate is like maybe between 10 to like 20 billion in terms of assets under management. So yeah, so taking care of funds, everything from calling capital, making distributions. And these types of funds are different because they are closed-ended funds that are capital call structure. So people commit like 10 million, they'll raise like $1 billion fund and investor will commit like $100 million to the fund. They will not call all $100 million. They will call that money over a certain period of time that is agreed upon in the PPM and subscription agreement. And then they also have a set period of time to deploy that money. So to use that money and buy assets. So once the investment period ends, anything that they've identified during that investment period is what they can buy. And then once that's done, they then have to create a new fund. So
yeah, that's batting in a different league, really, than the rest of us are playing in. And you know, one of the things that we commonly hear in those bigger, you know, for the bigger players is that actually the deployment of capital into meaningful investments mm-hmm. is challenging.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see the return profiles? Let me ask this. Are the return profiles inside of those size of investment funds different than what you see really here on the kind of street level investor like us? Is it dramatically about the same?
I think it's around the same, but they just have more tools. So like one of the biggest tools I think they have is they have the ability to use like lines of credit. For instance, so like because they are working with large institutional investors, they can go to a bank, a reputable bank, who will then look at the list of investors and see which ones are bankable or not, and then actually lend the fund money from that commitment. So they then don't have to call from those investors. So then what that does is it enables them to borrow at lower rates because the rates might be like, say, 2%. To pay the bank. So then they're taking that money, buying real estate. Those real estate, many of those deals, some of them, depending on the type of fund, if you're dealing with a value add fund, then you have a fund that is actually buying properties that are operating. So they'll kick off cash flow, which they can then give to investors without even calling. So it can be that enables them to, you know, sort of ride the storms a little bit better than, say, investors, syndicators, and operators in this space that are just starting out.
Right.
Because they have those kinds of tools that are handy for them.
Yeah, man. That's, you know, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because as long, you know, dry powder is always helpful.
Mm-hmm. Especially, exactly.
Yeah. And especially when it's dry powder that you can get instantly.
Correct.
And the other thing that's interesting there is that, like you said, their debt to equity ratio goes up with the less equity they bring in from private investors, which then juices the return, probably.
Right. Yeah. Because this is cheaper money. And then they'll tap in, they'll call eventually and recoup everything and, you know, get it all cleared out, but not in the beginning.
What are some things that you saw, you know, that's certainly a tool to be envious of, but what are some things that you, as you developed your next chapter, that you said, I want to emulate the things that I learned in the institutional space as I go more out and develop your own strategy?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think that I would say that at this point in my journey, I think, number one, seeking to keep things simple, because I realized that sometimes very complex structures to appease different investors can become very costly, and it can eat into their returns because you have to pay for all these structuring in order to get this money in. So I think that one of the things for me is simplicity. And as someone who knows a lot of people that live outside the United States who would love to be able to invest in the US, one of the big hurdles that I see for myself is being able to provide opportunities for them to invest in the US, but always thinking about how can I do this in the most simple and legally, like simple, but also legal way, and then also tax efficient way. Like that is the ultimate challenge, is to like sort of solve that kind of problem. And I saw from working where I worked that the way they solve those problems, and that it's definitely a great way and it's definitely legal, but it also, it cuts into your returns. I think the other thing is that education, even institutional investors have to be reminded that if you're investing in, even institutional investors need to be reminded about the strategy of real estate they're investing in and the pros and cons. Because even sometimes they will fall in a situation where they will invest in an opportunistic fund expecting cash flow, when you have to have those difficult conversations that, hey, this is opportunistic. It's not value add. So this fund is actually buying development projects and that kind of stuff. So there's not going to be any cash flow for right now. So we're going to need to keep calling money from you for management fees and other kinds of fees, so that way we can continue to run this fund. Like, so having those kinds of conversations, I think it shows you that even that if you're an investor out there and you're thinking about investing in real estate syndications, to ask those questions, because even very well-qualified investors sometimes don't think about, oh, you know, opportunistic, probably no cash flow here. So you probably don't want to be investing in this if you want to be, you know, experiencing a cash flow coming in. So yeah, I think those are some of the things that I would say. I can't say that I'm trying to build a gigantic business like the one there that I just came from. I really love the idea of being able to seeing, I think I'm inspired by all of the entrepreneurs in this space that have been able to build a very lean business that doesn't require a gazillion employees, but also provides really good opportunities for people to invest in real estate. Which I was working there and I had no, until I met that lady, I had no idea that it was possible to invest in like private deals. And I remembered going to a lunch and asking people, hey, does anyone like know anyone that invests in self-storage? And people were just like, what? What's that? Like, why would you invest in that? Like, no way. And about a year or so later is when I met people who were actually investing in self-storage and that there were actually opportunities to do that. So yeah, there's a lot of misconceptions and limiting beliefs around the investment that's possible for non-institutional people. So yeah.
Right. Because you're in a corporate environment, you're asking people about investing and they're going, right, we don't really know anything about that. I mean, it's,
yeah,
that's kind of funny and kind of sad.
Yeah.
Because in their mind, everybody, you know, you have to be able to write $100 million check to play. So yeah. And so it's like, you just automatically turn it off and say, not how do I find a way to invest? You go, oh, I can't. So that's fascinating. So what other things? I know you mentioned early on, you know, keeping things simple, that complex becomes costly.
Yeah.
So what are some other things that come to mind when you say that?
I think that as I think about that, I think about like if you, by creating these different, so essentially what happens is you can create all these different kind of vehicles that enables foreign investors to invest in your deals. And that's what can drive some of these expenses. If the investments are doing very well, then you're fine. But if you have a situation where the investments aren't doing well, then, you know, you have a situation where you have all these entities and you just need money to keep them running and keep them going consistently. So it causes a drag, I would say, is something to think about. I think the other thing is, like, as people start out, like, you know, a lot of people ask me questions about funds and like raising funds and that kind of stuff. And I always tell them that for me personally, I'm focused on right now just single asset funds. So investing in one particular asset at the moment. That could definitely change. I'm open to leaving myself open to changing in the future. But the reason I've started in that place is because I am also familiar with, if you're going to call capital, then the most appropriate thing that needs to happen is you need to start ticking the pref. Because the moment you pull capital from investors, you need to start giving them some kind of return on their money. And that means that as an operator who's thinking about doing the fund model, because you're like, oh, this is a great way to have capital on hand, sense. So that way you can go acquire deals at the drop of a hat. But that means you need to make sure that your deal flow is on point, because then you need to be able to then provide returns. If not, then you're behind the eight ball on that pref return to investors. So just those kinds of things to think about. I also think that, you know, I've also spoken to very experienced operators who are like, oh, they would like to do a fund, but they just don't think it's possible. And then I meet other people who have been able to do it. So I think believing in yourself, believing that, you know, it's possible. And if you want to do something, like getting out there and talking to the people who are doing it, because they are out there doing it, to educate yourself about the legal ways to do it and to set yourself up properly to do it. So yeah, I think it's a great business. I love it. For me, you know, I see that in the future, hopefully I'm able to create funds that give investors the opportunity to invest in multiple recession resistant assets. So multifamily, mobile home park, self-storage, because like, I think it would be good. Like, I think there's a need for that. And I think people want to have exposure to that kind of, those kinds of asset classes. And that's one of the benefits of being a fund manager, is being able to add that kind of value to someone who wants that diversification.
Right. Which kind of brings me to my next question, which is, what does your business look like today? You know, now that you've exited corporate America, you have gone, you know, you're into real estate, but what does that blueprint that you developed over that 4.5 years look like in your business today?
Yeah. So my business today is, I am focused on being a fund manager. So what that means is I build relationships with investors who are interested in investing in real estate, specifically recession resistant real estate. Right now, my primary focus is multifamily, but my secondary focus is self-storage and mobile home parks. So on the other side of the hand, when I'm not building relationships with investors, I am building relationships with operators who are world-class in the space, who are looking for people to partner with, strategic partners who can create funds to then bring in really good capital. And I would then come in as an LP into their deal. I have my own fund, and then I can negotiate really good terms for my investor, for my fund. So that way I can then either keep the same returns for my investors or even better returns, just depending on the situation.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because maybe some of our listeners don't know, but as a lot of, you know, the bigger the check you can write, the better terms you may be able to negotiate.
Yes.
With the general partner.
Correct.
So if you're bringing a $50,000 check, you're probably going to get the same deal everybody else gets. But if you're bringing a $5 million check, well, maybe you'll get some preferential treatment where they'll shave off part of their general partnership fees and make your deal sweeter. Because that's one, that's 100 less people there, or 99 less people they have to deal with. Write a $5 million check. So that's,
and you know, one of your questions that you asked, you know, about like, you know, the lessons I learned from that experience, is one of the lessons I learned that I try to share with people is that even the big shops partner with strategic partners to bring capital to their deals.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. So I think that it's not going to go away, because people always need more capital. They're always, they want to raise a bigger fund. Okay, I've raised $1 billion this year. They want to raise a $2 billion fund next year. That's going to require them to meet more people and then potentially have more strategic partners that are able to then help them to bring that capital across the table. So yeah, and those partners do negotiate on fees as well. So everything from taking a portion of the management fee, taking a portion of the promote, placement fees, upfront fee, servicing fees, like there's all these different fees. So like, yeah, it's normal. It's a part of the process. I think that if you want to continue to build your business as an operator, I think it's something to think about, because it's like, okay, yeah, like even the big shops are going to be, are doing this. Like it's just a part of the process. So yeah.
Yeah. And you bring up a great point there, which I mean, that one, there's never a point at which you run out of a need for capital. Mm-hmm. So which just further refines the need to sharpen that skill in this business.
Right.
The point of the show is how to scale commercial real estate. So yeah, we're going to jump right back in here. But when it comes to a skill that everyone needs, it's that raising capital skill. So if you're going to scale your commercial real estate holdings, you've got to develop that skill. I mean, there's two skills, I think, and you've really refined or defined one of them really well for us today, which is raising capital. You know, finding deals and finding capital. And if you're not focusing on those two, then you're kind of not in the real estate game.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that's a really valuable point you bring up, that even the $1 billion fund managers are still out hunting for more capital from capital partners.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, before we jump into the final four questions, is there anything else really that we should be highlighting or talking about, you know, as it pertains to, you know, what you learn on the institutional side, what you are learning on the more private side? You know, is there some lessons you learned along the way or things that if you could go back and do it over that you would do differently? Anything like that?
You know, what I would say is lessons learned. I think that I'm glad that I was exposed to the fund model in terms of like being able to create my own fund in 2019 to do the deal that I did in Atlanta. Because as I speak to people who play in the space of like investor relations or just helping other people in terms of like bringing capital, but also doing other things on the GP as well, I think that sometimes they're not aware that they could do this fund model. It could help them in terms of building their own business, in terms of like protecting their investor base and continuing to establish your credibility and then ultimately being able to build a fund of their own as time goes on and they have that track record of selecting and partnering with good operators. So I think like if someone's listening, I want them to be left with this nugget that, hey, like this is possible for you and that there's resources out there and there are people who are doing this and it's legal and there is compliance stuff that you need to consider, but it doesn't mean that you should feel like as though it's not possible. So yeah.
Right. I love that. You know, one of the major hangups that especially starting out that people run into in the fund model is the cost of getting their fund mm-hmm. launched. How have you overcome that starting out?
Yeah, great question. So a couple things here. So this two ways. Luckily for me, I had a situation where I was able to find a company that was able to open up our LLC and subscription agreements in a economical way. So there are companies out there that can help you to get that done. That doesn't cost like 10 grand and 15 grand, but there are companies out there at the 10 and 15 grand mark. The second thing is talking to the operator. Because some operators, especially the ones who are raising $20 million for their deals and $100 million and all these kinds of large sums, might have arrangements with their attorneys to say, hey, you know what, I have fund managers. I know your typical fee is about 10 grand. Would you be willing to, since I'm bringing business to you as the lawyer, like, can you do a better deal from fund managers? So like that can be another way. So I think those are the two ways. And then once again, negotiating with the operator in terms of like how much money you're bringing to then be able to get a better deal for your entity as well. So that helps you with being able to take an upfront fee, everything from cutting fees in half to doing other things as well. So yeah.
Right. Yeah. We don't have time to get into kind of the merits of a fund, but I love what you're doing there. And that sure. That's great advice. Yeah. So I wouldn't have thought about is going to the operator side because especially the big boys are writing checks all the time to these attorneys. So they're going to want to keep their clients happy and say, sure, I'll help you out with your fund managers and, you know, get some deals or some documents done for them for maybe at a discount. So that's absolutely fantastic. Let's jump here into the final four if we can. First question is this. If I just gave you $20,000 to invest in real estate, what would you do with it and why?
So what I would do with it is I would seek to partner with maybe two to three other people who also have 20 grand to invest in a real estate syndication because I love real estate syndications that much.
I love it. That's creative. That's sort of like the genie that wishes for more wishes answer. The only thing you can't do is wish for more wishes. No, I like it. That's creative. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Yeah, two things. One, I think it's important to, if you're going to play actively, run your numbers and make sure that whatever investment you're going to buy on the active side, that you're actually generating some cash flow. Secondly, if you're going to be investing passively or in the syndication business at all, I think it's super important that you get to know the sponsor. Before anything, like it's just really important. If you like, trust the sponsor, verify that this is someone you would want to be in business with for the next 5 to 7 years before you deploy capital. Because I think sometimes people think that, oh, like this is the only deal. No, there's many deals. So just make sure you take the time to get comfortable that this is who you want to be investing with.
Right. That's absolutely great. Investing in the world. What's one thing you are doing to make the world a better place?
Yes, I would say for me is sharing my story, be it via my podcasts or my WAM meetings. I have weekly accountability calls with a few other entrepreneurs. And I feel that through sharing my story and through having these accountability calls, I feel like I know that it's helping me and it's helping them to achieve their goals and to continue to see when, oh, you know what? My train has gone off the track. At least you know this week that the train has gone off the track, as opposed to a month, 2 months later, the train has gone off the track and you've missed out like maybe half of the year. So yeah. And I think the last thing I would say is just being willing to take courageous steps. Deciding to leave my W-2 was one of the hardest things I've ever done. But I feel that I know that there are people who are following my story and who are just like, I wonder what's going to happen. So just being able to inspire them to know that, hey, you know what? It's not going to be easy and it isn't easy, but it's being able to keep showing up and keep pressing forward. So yeah.
Right. I love that. Lisa, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Sure. Best way is my website. So that's lisahilton.com. And so that's Hilton with a Y instead of I. So just like the hotel, Y with instead of an I. And then you just do /ebook. I have a free ebook called Investing in Real Estate for Beginner's Guide to Investing in Real Estate Syndications. So super easy.
That's awesome. Lisa, thank you so much for your time today. I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.